to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Bob Scott, former co-founder of the Kansas City Fellowship and author of three books. The latest is Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, the Kansas City Prophets, and the International House of Prayer. Bob, it's good to be back, and I'm a little bit excited to get into this. I've kind of been building up to these moments. I've got this list of things that I really want to pick your brain on, because you were there.
Yeah.
And you know, I've listened to many podcasts about IHOP KC, Kansas City Fellowship, all this, and it's all from people who learned about it after it went destructive. They really weren't there during the beginning. And there are some elements that you talk about that really match my story. And so I'm certain there's going to be a little bit of crossover. But basically, one of the things that I have been building up to is I want to learn more about the prophetic in the Kansas City Fellowship before it turned into the International House of Prayer.
Okay. And
there's a reason for this. So whenever William Branham was in his destructive phase, that would have been the phase that created the destructive cult I was in, he was the only one. I am the king prophet, there are no others, they're all fakes, they're all scoundrels, yada, yada, yada. But there was a moment in time prior to this, much like the Kansas City Fellowship prior to International House of Prayer, where it was building up this idea of this fivefold ministry where there's prophets, apostles, you know, teachers, pastors, etc. Well, in that moment, there were many prophets that were coming forward. There were many apostles coming forward, and they were all kind of joined in unity. And what happened is they built this platform from which they could build other ministries, and they started to watch those grow, and it became like this pyramid scheme of religion. It was, you know, there's a point of time in which Latter Rain and the Voice of Healing revivals combined to form the post-World War II healing revivals, and then they split. After they kind of split because of this thing I'm talking about, but there were many prophets, and then after the split, each group, if you study the climax of their destructive cult, they're usually, I'm the only one, there are no others. they all go down that same pathway. So I wanted to talk to you about the prophetic as it relates to the Kansas City Fellowship.
That'll be a fun topic. You know, one thing that fascinates me about our relationship is that in many ways, we couldn't be more different in terms of our journey. You know, you grew up in this Pentecostal world. I grew up a Catholic kid in Milwaukee. And I lasted until my teenage years. But then I got kicked out of CCD for asking if we could study other religions. And my reasoning was my father was looking for a new car, and we were out driving and sampling all these other cars to make a decision, and they had stuck me in this Catholic catechism class, and we only had one option, and I wanted to know what my other options were. Anyways, that got me in big trouble. So then I spent the next 7 years being an existentialist, even though I didn't know that was the word for it. Only when I was 18, I ended up having a rather interesting spiritual experience in the middle of the night, which created this curiosity of, you know, who's God and what's out there. So I went to my parents' pastor, who is evangelical. So here I am then going to an evangelical Bible school, being taught that the gifts of the Holy Spirit are a dispensation that's past. Those things are no longer relevant, blah, 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 blah. I meet Mike Bickle. We're roommates at Bible school. After Bible school, we reconnect after not talking, and he tells me he's pastoring a church in Rosebud, and I should come down and visit him. So here I am. I drive from Milwaukee down to Rosebud, Missouri, to this little country church that he's his first pastorate. And I arrive in the middle of the week, so I don't, you know, I'm just meeting him and some of the guys that are hanging with him. And then Sunday morning, we have church service, and this place is like a wild Pentecostal event that I have never in my life experienced, right? It's got wood floors, right? The old wood floor country church. So people are stomping and there's all this stuff going on and I'm horrified, right? Because here I am with my roommate from Bible school, right? Who is an evangelical and we're in the middle of a Pentecostal church and my head was spinning. But it tells you a little bit about Mike's psyche, right? It's like he was so bound and determined to be in the ministry. He didn't care what flavor it was. He just wanted a church. So after the meeting, I like pulled him aside. I was like, horrified. I go, what are you doing? What are you doing? And he like winks at me and goes, don't worry. I'll have them all converted in 3 months to, you know, evangelical. Well, of course, that never happened, right? We get pulled further and further into it. I end up going to these meetings in Union, Missouri, which was kind of the county center, you know, and it's full gospel businessmen. So suddenly now I'm with a whole group of guys that are telling me that my proof of being a Christian is that I'm supposed to be speaking in tongues. Like, I have no idea what this is, right? But I just listen to all these people babbling, right? And of course, my brain is just freaking out here, right? It's just like, what am I into? So you can imagine, right? This is only a few years before Kansas City. So we moved to Kansas City and opened the church in November of 1982. And in March of 83, this roly-poly white-haired guy shows up with electrical pulses going through his fingers and just saying weird stuff, right? Just like, oh my God, you know what I mean? It's just, you can imagine, it's just like, this was a collision. Like, so in your world, that would be like normal, right? It's like, oh yeah, yeah, I grew up with this. In my world, this was like, what is this, right? So here I am now, I'm the associate pastor of this church, and suddenly now we have this force, this spiritual something, if it is, that is, has just come crashing into our church. Because the whole purpose of the church initially was a giant prayer meeting. It was sort of modeled after the Moravians and their 100-year prayer meeting. Mike wanted to have day and night prayer. So the whole focus was prayer, right? And then suddenly we end up having this prophetic thing just T-bone us, or what was claimed to be prophetic, right? So just sidebar here, even though my book is called Some Say They Blundered, the original title was Prophetic or Pathetic. And the reason being is then the next 8 years of my, well, 7 years really, the next 7 years of my life were me trying to struggle with exactly what you're talking about, this systemic prophetic thing, because it literally changed the whole culture of our church. I mean, it literally took over. I mean, it was, I mean, I don't mean this derogatory, but it was like a weed. It just literally, we were having prayer meetings and suddenly now Mike puts this guy on stage who's got these weird things he's saying, and people are just lapping it up. And I'm sitting there struggling, going, okay, this, I don't know if this is good or bad. I don't know what this is, right? And so I spent the next 7 years just drilling down, asking a lot of questions, which got me into a lot of trouble and sideways with Mike on a lot of things, because people didn't like my questions.
Whenever you are on the outside of what I was in, and you're looking in, what you see when you see Branhamism, you see Pentecostalism, you see elements, trace elements of Latter Rain, all of these different things, and you describe the people much like you described me. Here's the funny part. While I was in it, we often heard sermons how we're not like those Pentecostals.
Really?
And I, yes. Yeah, so wow. I had in my head, I had That's programmed and indoctrinated this idea that I wasn't Pentecostal. And yet we were Pentecostal through and through. That's the funny part.
Now you got my brain going here. So why was that? Why did they need to make that distinction? Was there some conflict with Springfield?
Well, think of how a destructive cult works.
And in by the way, people, if you don't know what Springfield is, it's the headquarters of the Assembly of God. So
exactly. So think about how a destructive cult works. At first, as you're building the cult, everybody's welcome. Come join our cult. Mm. It doesn't matter if you're going to church A, B, or C. We want to have fellowship one with another. And then once you get them in your group, you start talking about how bad churches A, B, and C are.
Oh, you guys
need to leave those things.
Right.
Well, that's the way this worked. So Branham in the beginning, he would say things like, if people draw you out of your circle, draw a bigger circle and draw them back in. Everybody's welcome, and everybody from Catholics to Baptists to Methodists, etc. Well, once he started being sanctioned by different groups, the Assemblies was the first in 1949, I think it was. They issued this resolution and said Lateran is a bunch of very destructive groups. So they cut Branham off. And what's interesting is that created this split in Pentecostalism. You were either with Branham and the Lateran or you weren't. And Branham was walking down the middle of this, trying to wait on both sides. And so what would happen is he would say things that were either side could approve it until they fully cut him off, and then he denounced them. And Got this it. Went all the way through until he finally is denouncing Pentecostalism in general. Well, what happens is he's dead. Now we have all of these people who are believing that every word spoken by this guy is the divine word of God. And how do you reconcile this? In the beginning, he's favorable with the Pentecostals. Right. In the end, he condemns them. Well, it must have been progressive revelation. So, so towards the end, he's not Pentecostal. None of us are Pentecostal. We're different than those Pentecostals.
We're other.
And the other,
we're
right?
holy, right? We're other.
Exactly. And how that relates to this conversation is this. Towards the end, he becomes the all-in-wonder prophet. There are no others. They're all the mockeries. They're all the fake that's sent to deceive you. And we were given that mindset. The fivefold ministry really didn't exist. There was the kingpin, who is now dead, and there's everybody else. But what happened was each minister who rose up tried to become central figures of their own, and so they would fight with each other. You would have cities where there might be five different churches of the same denomination, none of which could fellowship with each other. They're all different. And so what would happen is you had a guy who's not claiming to be prophetic, because that would step on Branham's toes. He's claiming to be in the fivefold. He's just a pastor. Where it got really interesting as it relates to this conversation is I was in one specific church, and they invited back in the old days, you'd call it the circuit rider preacher, but basically this missionary type preacher that's going from church to church and preaches a normal sermon. And then at the end, he pretends like he has this prophetic gift. I'm about 22 years old at the time. I could see straight through him, and he was doing stupid stuff, like picking out people based off of the way they're dressing, obvious things, right? And saying, God has told me that you sitting there. And he goes through this spiel. Well, it's all fake to me, but he's in this church pretending to be a prophet, and the minister's allowing it. So when I think about Kansas City Fellowship, and in the early years of this, there were multiple prophets there that kind of, some of them disappeared. Jed talks about his father and how he was cut off. But then towards the end, as you're starting to write what is called the prophetic history, you limit this to the cult's central mythology. So the mythology basically replaces the idea that there's this prophetic gift coming to the church.
Well, if you'll indulge me for a second, I want to put on my sociology hat because I think there's a cultural sociology dynamic that not only impacts the church world, but secular culture as well. And it's what I call the influence pie. All through history you know, I'm an avid historian, and so I watch all these battles. And what I became to realize is what the battle always is who's got the most influence. That's where all that, whether it's political, you know what I mean, whether it's religious, whatever. And so the reason I use the analogy of a pie is that a pot, you know, there's a limited amount of people in a particular area, right? And so then there's a group of people in there, and they're all vying to be influential. I learned this the hard way in Zimbabwe with my friends that got killed. They got killed because in the civilization, they gained influence because they were saving people from a genocide and feeding people who were starving. The government was losing influence. And what I was so naive of it as a 30-year-old was that whenever somebody gains influence, somebody else is losing it, right? The pie is only so big. When somebody starts losing influence, conflict arises, and sometimes it gets deadly because you become a threat, right? The minute your influence increases over somebody who's powerful, right? In this case, they had guns and, you know, they had a military and all that kind of stuff. So they were able to take these people out. It's the same thing in the church world, right? And I find it fascinating, fast-forwarding now to our modern culture, when you see people defined today in the social media world, what are they called? Influencers. So this is so funny to me, because here I am kind of figuring all this stuff out in the 80s about influence, and now years later, that's like a common term. They're an influencer. Well, what are they influencing? Right? Who are they influencing? It gets, right? And then there's a battle. You're seeing it now. I mean, I want to stay away from politics here, but you're seeing it in the post Charlie Kirk world of Turning Point USA, right? And I had told some friends of mine that are on the board there, this is exactly what's going to happen now that Charlie's gone. Watch this. And they're all calling me down going, oh my God, how did you know? And I said, it doesn't take a prophet. It takes a historian and a sociologist. This happens everywhere all the time, right? So exactly what you're describing about what happened, it's a battle, right? And then initially, the battle was between the Assemblies of God in Springfield and, you know, the Branhamites in, what, Jeffersonville? Is that where the headquarters was?
Actually, it goes a little bit beyond that, because there were states that became rogue states within the Assemblies. So Kentucky, for example, I've had people from Kentucky who were in the standard Assemblies of God churches that denounced Latter Rain, who were inviting Latter Rain ministers, which is right. kind of
funny.
But
you see the battle? It's all about who, again, it gets down to, this is where, why James 3:16 to me is just as important almost as John 3:16. Because James said, wherever you have selfish ambition and greed, right, you're going to have chaos and evil, right? So wherever there's a drive for status and stuff, i.e. gaining influence, right, wherever that's the motive, you're going to have conflict, chaos, evil. People are going to do bad things, right? And it's like, for somebody like me, who's, you know, like I said, studied history and sociology, I just keep, it's like a broken record. It just keeps happening over and over and over. And once you begin to see it, right, you see it's everywhere. There's a reason why there's 40,000 Pentecostal denominations. Like, is that the most ridiculous number? Why do we need 40,000 Protestant denominations, right? You know why? Because somebody was driven by the lust for status and stuff and wanted influence, right? And somebody wasn't giving it to them, so they threw a little hissy fit and went off and started another thing. Right. So they could have influence. Right. So the whole, so where you're going with it is then what ends up happening once that person makes that move, because they're driven by this desire to be influencers, is it becomes systemic. right? They have to create a system to maintain the influence, right? And that's where you start getting memberships and signing up and loyalty and donation, right? You see this whole thing. And it's, you know, in the business world, we call it a sticky relationship, right? We want to have a sticky relationship with our clients, you know, and so because we want to upsell other services, right? We want to handle this and we want to handle that for them. So we want to integrate them into our, you know, into our business services or software or whatever, so that they always need us, right? They're always dependent on the next upgrade, and so we have a continual revenue stream. It's not any different in the church world. And this is what, you know, because of my Joseph Company global world, and if, you know, if we can have a whole conversation about that sometime, but I live between the business world, you know, the secular and the sacred world, as people like to define it, even though from God's perspective, there is no secular, sacred world. Like, that just doesn't exist. But I see it all the time, right? So it's like people just think because we're the church and we're serve God that we're like different, right? And we're not. It's like, yeah, we do all the same things. We just put religious words on it and it makes us feel like we're really being spiritual, right? Yeah. But it's the same motives.
Exactly. And so ironically, you're describing where I was hoping that you would head, but I didn't want to lead you there because I wanted you to tell it as it was. But so go back to the very beginning of this. Pentecostalism's kind of dying out. It does exist, uh-huh, but it's not the same. It doesn't have the same force that it did in the early 1900s. Latter Rain is basically the second iteration of this. And whenever they initially started this revival and it started spreading and became this thing that overwhelmed the Assemblies of God so much so that they denounced it, there was a weird aspect of truth in it, even though it was mixed with things that weren't quite, you know, sane. I'll say it like that. But it in it was this: the reason why the Assemblies of God denounced it is because there wasn't really a system of checks and balances on who could become a prophet.
Right.
They basically, you could lay hands on someone and deem them to be a prophet, and then suddenly,
there's no accountability.
Magically, you've got an unaccountable prophet.
Yeah.
But there was a biblical aspect that got removed later on. I don't know if you've thought about this. There is a passage, I believe it's in Corinthians, that says, let two or three prophets speak and let others judge. And
right.
If you study that word judge, it means weigh, evaluate, discern. Basically, is this a true prophecy or is this just some guy that's full of it? And in the early years, whenever everybody's welcome, everybody can be a prophet, you can be a prophet, you can be a prophet, you too can be a prophet. Well, they did this kind of thing. The prophets would prophesy, and somewhere I read, it might have even been in one of Branham's sermons, there were people that were doing this in the back room before services, and people would weigh the prophecies and see are they accurate. And then what happened is over time, as this thing that you're talking about, where the balances kind of shift and some guy wants status and stuff, or some girl, there were females that did this too, once they wanted to become the big wig, well, no longer are they accountable to the others when they prophesy.
Yeah.
And so that shift happened. And, you know, like I said, the Assemblies of God saw right very quickly, this is bad, guys. You need to stop this. Not everybody did until, really, I want to say it was more towards the shepherding side of things. Whenever this is just so destructive, people, don't do this. And it kind of dissolved a little bit. And I often talk negatively about Wimber and some of the things that Chuck Smith was involved with. But in this one area, I would say that they're actually more towards the biblical side than what was brewing in the Latter Rain post-World War II healing side. They kind of did, they didn't want authoritarian structures. Wimber did not. Chuck Smith did not. And then what happened is really odd, because fast forward to the Kansas City Fellowship, you have people who were clearly Branhamite. Paul Kane was clearly a Branhamite.
Oh, yeah, he loved William Branham.
We've not talked about it much, but I've talked to him on the phone, and right up to his death, he's promoting Branham. You've got Bob Jones, who was also promoting Branham, very strong Branhamites.
Yeah.
And what did they do?
Which, of course, I was utterly naive to, because I'd never heard the name William Branham, right? It's only until I got a hold of Harold's book, All Things Are Possible. I had no idea. Right? I'm just this evangelical Catholic kid trying to hang on to the tail of a tiger, right? And this thing is so out of control. And then when I read Harold's book, I went, oh my God, that's us.
Yeah.
Like, this is where, this, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, some of you that know my story know that I was adopted, and I only learned a few years ago my actual biological history. But it was sort of the same thing with our church family, right? It's like, oh my God, that's who our daddy is. It's like, I didn't know that, right? It was like, oh my God. That way, it made so much sense, right? It was suddenly, you know, like all these pieces of things that you're seeing, feeling, whatever, that you can't contextualize, right? Because it's just like they're all happening and it's all dynamic. And then suddenly you read something and you go, oh my God, that's how this all comes together. Who's your daddy? Yeah. That was William Branham.
Well, exactly. So you have these Branhamites, and you've got this world where there are people who are authoritarian figures. It's not that it doesn't exist, but it's not as widespread. Mm. And what happens is you have these people who are Branhamites start the working with Mike Bickle, the Kansas City Fellowship. They basically institutionalize prophecy, yeah, and they basically turn it back to what Branham had created in the destructive years of his cult, whenever, wow, prophets were not accountable to anybody. There was no, this let two or three prophets speak and let others judge. There, right, was no accountability for the prophecy. And that really set the foundation, it set the pace for what would become the New Apostolic Reformation, authoritarian, wow, figures.
Well, one of the big conflicts that Mike and I had early on was that, because of Bob Jones's prophecies about Mike, right, that reinforced Mike's elite, spiritual eliteness, right, fed, you know, the myth of Mike, the mythology around Mike, right, making him more influential, right? It's like Bob's, you know, Mike platformed him. My problem where Mike and I would get into conflicts, it was like, Mike, I have a passion for the prophetic. Like, I see where this can go if it's really God. This isn't it. Like, this is not the guy that I want to be modeling what is prophetic, right? Well, I got overruled, like totally overruled. And I understand later why I got overruled, because this was, you know, Bob was the spiritual energy, right? That was, you know, he was the gas in Mike's tank. He was the nitro, actually. He was the, you know, Mike already was a dynamic personality, but Bob's prophecies about Mike were like an injection of nitro. It just took everything. But here's what, where it got institutionalized in our world, is because Mike platformed Bob and gave him such stature, guess what happened in the church? Everyone wanted to be Bob Jones. And this is where I really had problems, right? Because you had this whole group of young people who don't really have any history, any context, no theology, right? But they are pumped, right? Mike's got everybody jacked up, and Bob's feeding all this. And because Mike put Bob on a stage, right, what does everybody see? Oh, if I want influence with Mike and the guys in leadership, the way to do it is to be like Bob. Well, I'm looking at this going, no, don't be like Bob, right? But I'm in the middle of a buffalo stampede, right? It's just like suddenly when this thing hits critical mass, it got so freaking weird that nobody could talk to you like a real human being. Everybody suddenly became parabolic, because Bob would talk in parables. Like, he would, it's sort of like, I don't know if you've ever seen Being There with Peter Sellers, but it's the story of this guy, Chauncey Gardner, who's basically, has some sort of disability, and he's grown up his whole life serving a rich guy. He gets kicked out into the real world, but nobody realizes that he's actually slow. Like he's, you know, he's got a disability. And so anyways, in the movie, through a whole series of weird things, he ends up meeting world leaders. And he's going, when the snow falls in the spring and the plant, right? And he's giving them these little gardening analogies, and all these world leaders are hanging on the edge of their seats, right? Because this guy is so profound. I remember when I saw that movie, I was like, oh my God, this is like Bob Jones, right? In our world, right? It's like, this guy is a blue collar, you know, he lives in this little bungalow in Independence, Missouri, right? This little one bedroom house. He's like a tree trimmer. He's uneducated, right? And ever, but because he speaks parabolically, everybody suddenly thinks he's profound. So suddenly now I'm trying to interact with people who cannot have a conversation with me because it's, well, brother, God showed me, and I had this, right? And what got interesting to me, and this is how weird this gets, is it was like, because Bob spoke in these weird parables, now everybody had to tell you their parable, right? And the reason was, is because the weird dream or vision that they had was the thing that validated their propheticness, not the actual point of the whole thing, right? Yeah. So I was like, can you just tell me that, like, what's the point here, right? It's like, can we just forget all the how you got it and just tell me what, right? And it got like that to the point where it was like, this is weird. Like if anybody walked in on this from the outside world, to be like, who are these people? Where this even got weirder was because of Mike's whole focus on end time revival, right? So it became this, not only we're all prophets, right? And we all speak in parables, and we all have dreams and visions. It's like, we're all getting ready to lead this end time revival, which is going to solve all the world's problems. Because the way that Mike's presenting it is that when the revival comes, the apostles and prophets are going to rule the nations, right? And it's all going to get better. And I'm watching all this and I'm going, this thing's out of control, you know? And so me and Mike are fighting behind the scenes because I think, you know, this is, I mean, you know, we're in space now, like,
yeah.
We're untethered. Like, we are going down a road here that it's not going to end well. And I remember in July of 1989, Mike ended up putting the three guys on a stage in Anaheim. And I watched what I call later the dueling prophets, right? And to go back to your world, because of the fact that these guys all wanted to be influential, right? Because it's all about, you know, being influential. They start competing with each other on stage about who could have the most dramatic prophecy. So the thing escalates, right? It starts, you know, with a word, you know, for sister so-and-so and brother whatever. And by the end of the meeting, I mean, it's, you know, it's worldwide revival and blah, blah, blah. Like, and it's just, and the crowd's going crazy. And I'm watching all this going, oh my God, because the crowd doesn't know that egos, right? This need to be influential, this need to be seen as whatever is actually driving all this. They think it's God. And because it's tickling all their ears, they're like going crazy, right? Long story short, even before this event happened, I got so concerned about it. Mike had to go somewhere. And so he goes, hey, you know, I did not like being in the pulpit. I don't like public speaking. And he goes, can you give a message? So I just decide to speak my truth, right? And my truth was this, that I had discovered in reading the book of Acts that every time the supernatural power of God moved, people got hurt. And there were three groups of people. It was either religious leaders, economic leaders, or political leaders that attacked the early church and the leaders. In other words, real authentic spiritual power threatens people in power because you're gaining influence and they're losing it. And they get mad and they beat you up and they throw you in jail and they stone you to death. So I end up giving a message at the church called The Glory and the Gory, The Other Side of Revival. And I remember standing up there and people's mouths were just like, right? Because nobody had actually opened the Bible and showed them what really happens when the power of God moves. People die. People get martyred. That's what happens. And so it's like I brought this real kind of sober, like at the end of the meeting, nobody was talking. Like it was dead silence, right? Because I told them, I go, so you all want to do this? Well, you know, get prepared.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. You know, there's another Bible verse that it goes hand in hand with what is happening here. And the other irony is that you're talking about exactly where I was wanting you to go with the second point before I got there again. And we've not compared notes at all.
No, we've never had this conversation.
In 1 John, I think it's 1 John 4, it says to test every spirit to make sure whether the spirit is of God or not. So Bob Jones comes in and he's talking in all of these parables and people see it. And there's not anybody who's really heeding that scripture. They're not really testing, well, is he just full of it or is this something
from God? Well, some are, right? There were some people that left because of Bob Jones. So, but the vast majority stayed because they loved what he was saying, right?
Exactly.
And tickled their ears.
And there's a reason for that. So within Branhamism, this is kind of a thing. And I look at IHOP KC much like I do Branhamism 2.0. Whenever you speak, often your brain disengages from your mouth. This is a problem that many, many people have. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just simply you're processing at a slower rate than you're speaking. And people will say things and then suddenly realize, I made a mistake. And the normal person who's not been affected by any of this nonsense would say their conscience just kind of stopped them and said, my conscience stopped me because I told you something that wasn't true. What I meant to say was, and they will back up and say this. Well, in Branhamism, one of the tricks that he did, and this was brilliant if you think about it, to bypass that scripture where you're supposed to test the spirits, what do you do to bypass this? If one person claims they have a spirit and they're talking prophecy, they're talking all of these things, one person is doing it. Well, everybody who knows their Bible is going to look at that person and say, well, we need to test it because that's what it says in 1 John. But if instead you try to bring everything down to the spirit level, everything. Now you've got people who they're walking in the spirit constantly. And he trained people to believe that that conscience, that inner voice that every human has, well, even if you're an atheist, you have this, train them to believe that that's God speaking to you. And I remember sermon after sermon, if you hear that still small voice, brother, and it tells you, you better obey it. And would give examples exactly like I just did, where if you've said something that's untrue, well, that's your conscience. That's what atheists, that's what Buddhist, Muslim, Catholic, everybody has this. But if you bring it down to the level where everybody is now in the spirit, how do you test this? Because there are too many right. people. It would overwhelm right. the system. And that's exactly right. what he did. He overwhelmed the system.
Interesting.
So once you institutionalize prophecy, then bring every single thing down to the spirit realm where everybody has the spirit. There's another thing that happens when you do this. There are people who are so arrogant, they don't want their spirit to be tested. Yeah, so once right. it's down to that level, nobody wants their spirit to be tested. Anybody who claims to have it, well, we're just going to randomly say, yes, they've got it because they told us they have
well,
it.
Well, you know what happens when you do that? They split off and start another church. Right. That's why we have all these denominations, because somebody got held accountable and they go, I don't want to be held accountable. I mean, that's the whole reason, you know, why Mike started IHOP. And people don't know the real story unless they read my book about it. But he didn't want to be accountable to a group of guys. So he ends up coming up with this, you know, miraculous spiritual event. Right. That, you know, that, you know, authorized him to go start. You know, what he was really called to, right? All the whole time hiding a secret that he didn't want anybody else to find out.
Absolutely. And think about watching a mystery movie. If you watch a really good mystery movie, they give you hints and clues yeah. along the way to string you along.
Yeah, that's right.
And then suddenly the mystery unfolds, and before they have explained all of these things in the past, your brain has connected to it because you already know those milestones.
Right.
And you think you're brilliant. You think you're a wizard. You solved the mystery. And you don't realize that they've strung you along like this.
They've strung you along.
Well, this is a normal thing that happens in human beings. Their brain is thinking subconsciously, even just simply reading. They're taking mental notes. And there's points at which the brain kind of combines those mental notes and you start to form a thought. And that thought may not match exactly what you're reading at the time you're reading it. Mm-hmm. So you may read through the Bible and you've been studying, I don't know, Zechariah or some other mm-hmm. passage, and suddenly you're reading Revelation and your brain makes that connection. Well, because everything's down to the spiritual level, people think, oh my gosh, God just spoke to me and revealed this scripture to me. Mm-hmm. And you talk about spinning off denominations. Well, what if the connection that you just made, which may or may not even be accurate, differs from the connection made by the other guy in the church,
and
both of those differ from the leader who has a different connection? Well, now you've got a leader who's wanting to fight against the two people. The two people want to break away and mm-hmm. start their own group, and that's literally how all of this Pentecostal mess started to ebb and flow and split and divide.
Well, I've been in the religious world for 50 years, and I can tell you I've got dozens of stories of guys who started churches even in our world because we didn't platform them, right? It was just I saw it over and over again, and part of the reason was that I have a sixth sense about things, and I could tell early on what was driving, what was motivating them, right? And I was like, this is trouble. And so I would not put them on staff, which resulted in, there's a lot of churches in Kansas City from guys who I didn't put on staff, right? One thing I was thinking about this, this whole issue of influence. You know, one of the things that preachers figured out is that people love to be told what they want to hear. The church world in my lifetime, in your lifetime, has gone from it's I exist to serve God to God exists to serve me. I have watched this transition in the church world, and you can see it in the pulpits every Sunday morning, because what happens is that the preachers get up and they tell people what they want to hear. It's all about God wants to give you this, God wants to do that, God want, right? And it's, and oh, by the way, it's all the things that I want. So one of the things that I was very saddened by is I saw this creep into the prophetic, right? And I saw so many of these wannabe prophets standing up and telling people what they wanted to hear. And I used to sit there, and because I can't explain it, but I get a physiological reaction to bullshit. Sorry, people. I know you don't like me to swear, but I don't know any other way to say it. It stunk really bad. And I could feel it, right? And it's just like gross. It's like, ew. It's like you want to go home and take a shower. You know, John Wimber used to have this phrase called I've been slimed, right? It was like I think he got it from Ghostbusters or something like that. I mean, this slime, right? And so much of the church world is just slimy, right? Because it's people who are driven by selfish ambition and greed, right? Seeking influence. And in order to get it, they flatter people. And so that's how far things have sort of descended. And one of the reasons, funny enough, this is the paradox of all this, is that in thinking, by telling everybody what they want to hear, that they're going to gain more influence and grow the church has actually shrunk. The American church is half of what it was when we were kids. You know, half the amount of people go to church anymore, right? So somehow the flattery isn't working for a lot of people, right? And the reason was, as I've discovered, is people may not all be prophets, but most everybody has some level of discernment. Like, they have a little meter too, right? And it's just like, ew, right? It's like, I remember, you know, I loved honey. You know, you put a little bit on your cereal, right? And so one day I was like, I'm going to take a big tablespoon of it. So I put a big tablespoon of honey in my mouth. I almost gagged. It was like, it was overwhelming, right? And I think that's what flattery, what's happened in the church, even in the prophetic world, right? It's just flattery, flattery, flattery. And it's systemic. And now, once, and this is where I get really concerned, because there's this entrenched system that has all these unspoken rules. And so anybody that's young and coming into the system now models themselves after all of this, right? That's why I said, I don't think we have prophetic. I think what we have is pathetic. And I know that's harsh, but I'm just trying to get people to understand that we've lost the real prophetic edge. They really lost it. And the driving force, the two driving forces behind it are ego and finances. I remember, this is a true story, I remember Paul Kane and I had this conversation because he preached something and I happened to have written it for him. And he didn't, there was a whole part of it which was counting, you know, there was an accountability, like it was just, you know, bringing, like holding a plumb line up. And he never talked about it. And so after the meeting, I went, hey, you cut out a whole part of the sermon. And he goes, well, if I said that, they'd never invite me back. And it is, like, he was just being honest about it, right? And I was like, yeah, that's the way most of these itinerant guys are. If I said that, right? And that's, you know, so it gets back to what you're talking about. It's this whole systemic thing that's become so entrenched now that I don't know how this gets put back on track. I mean, you know, typically, I mean, historically, what ends up happening is there's a T-bone. I call it T-bone. Something unexpected comes out of nowhere that completely upsets the system, right? As I wrote in my book, you take money out of the church world, the American church world, and you would have a completely different looking world that would all be based on authenticity and real relationships, sort of what you have in China. There's a reason why the Chinese church is so massive, right? Because it's illegal, right? There's no money involved. So they have authentic relationships with people who guide them and guard them against a system that's, right? In some ways, that would be the healthiest thing that happened in the American church, is something comes and opposes it.
And without that opposition, so that's how we ended up in this place, to be honest. So if you go back to the beginning, if there were two or three prophets, not one that could become authoritarian, two or three, and they prophesied, and then people judged their prophecies to see, are they true or false? Is this guy making it up or not? Then you would be testing the prophecy. Right. If you were to also test the spirits, then you would be testing to see, is this person really of God, or is this guy mm-hmm. mentally insane? And there's some good questions there with Bob Jones of maybe not insane, but some of his mental stability, mental faculties mm-hmm. may have been missing. But here's where it gets interesting. For everybody who's outside of all of this looking in, they say, how can you avoid passages like Deuteronomy 18, 20, I think, 21, I think it is, when a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, and that word does not come to pass, that is not a word that God has spoken. That's a very obvious thing. If you say something,
it's either it is or is it, right?
If you tell me something and it doesn't happen like you said, well, obviously what you said was untrue. A normal human being thinks like this. Well, because everything was brought down to the spiritual level, you can have the spirit, you can have the spirit. If you have a conscience, it's a spirit. You can't test the spirits because we're not going to test it in this group. We're going to train people not to test it. Well, there's one aspect which you just mentioned. Ironically, this is the third time. One aspect that alters the course of what is prophecy, and it actually dumbs it down. Mm. If you really go back and study, and I've spent 5 years doing this. I'm fascinated with psychology and culture and history. If you go back and you study the prophecies that were being issued by these men, not just Branham, but there was multiple men doing this, but don't study just what they say is coming to pass, study their audience. They're talking, you know, Gordon Lindsay is talking to Christian Identity people in Christian Identity conferences. Branham is talking to people who are working with the Klan, also Christian Identity people. They're speaking to Pentecostals who are not wanting change to happen. There's this fundamental rejection to change, especially modernization in that era, maybe not now, but in that era. Most of the prophecies have to do with either A, people who were deeply affected by World War II, and they remember those things, and it's appealing to think through them. B, opposition to change in the prophecy. They don't want this change to happen. We don't like this change. It's too modern for us. C, just simply things that they want to hear that are related to doctrines that they have taught them to believe. Well, if you teach a people in a certain way as it relates to Scripture, and then have a prophecy in that direction that you've trained them, everybody's going to accept it, right?
Yeah.
And because you're telling them prophecies that they want to hear, they're not going to test it. That was one of the strategies that was employed here. And I look back, obviously I've not studied every prophecy, but I've gone a lot through what Paul Kane was doing, some of what Bob Jones was doing. I've went right down the line with these guys. Bickle, I've talked through Jed. Many of the prophecies, they were either things that people wanted to hear, or they were directly tied to doctrines that they had planted breadcrumbs, much like that movie mystery that I'm talking about, where you give all the seeds that are taking you right down that path. Well, they strung them along and then gave the prophecy down the path that they had strung them. And so you're giving them prophecies that they want to hear. And in the end, what happens is people aren't going to test this. They don't care to test it. They believe it whether it comes true or not, they're going to believe it.
I think there's great wisdom in that biblical verse. And here's why. Here's where my brain goes with this. God put into the DNA of life a principle. And the principle is resistance builds strength. It's woven into everything in life, right? Whether, you know, if you work out, right? The reason you're working out is you are fighting resistance, you know? That's what builds you up. If you go back and you study people's stories, right? People that have come from really difficult childhoods, it's about what they overcame, right? Life was resisting them. Culture was resisting them. Things were against them. And they got stronger because they overcame it. I think because of the fact that we do not hold people accountable, to your point, and we do not judge, and we do not resist, what we have is pathetic. It's weak. It's anemic, right? It's a giant jellyfish, right? It has no backbone. And that's one of the reasons why the church world has lost its influence, right? It's just sorry, but it's weak. And so what's even more embarrassing to me, and again, this is so cliche-ish, but what we really have is, instead of emperors without clothes, we've got prophets without clothes. It's like this is embarrassing. What's sad, though, is because it's a system, right? And people are taught where to look, what to see, and how to interpret it. There's a whole group of people out there who are told, oh, the prophet's got clothes. So they all see clothes, right? And it's like, you know, that little innocent one, he's naked.
Yeah.
And you see, I see this all the time in the church world. That's why they all come to me behind the scenes, because they're in these situations like everybody's going, oh my God, oh my God. Right? And they're like, yeah, but this doesn't seem real to me. Like, this is not authentic. And you're like, yeah, yeah. And the reason is because you've not been inundated, saturated, manipulated, brainwashed by the system. And that's what people, I don't think, understand. Something, again, and I know we got to wrap this up, but I learned something a long time ago. When you're in a discussion with somebody and there's two different points of view and you're trying to convince them to see things like you see it, and they start to get emotive, right? You'll see this happen, right? It's like you're having this discussion about the facts. And then things start getting a little bit more, it starts escalating up, right? And then you get to a point where if it really goes off the rails, people go ad hominem, meaning that they don't no longer talk about the facts, they attack you personally, your character, you're an idiot, you, right, whatever. I was always, you know, I'm so logical, it's like, I don't understand, like, it's like, what happened to the facts here, right? What I didn't understand is that we all grow up in these little subcultures, in these little systems, whether it's your family, your friends, your peers, you know, your ethnicity, right? You have a subculture. That subculture has a worldview. It has a system. The only way that you can maintain your relationships in the system is to conform. When you start trying to convince people to think differently, what you don't realize is you're actually creating fear, like absolute paranoia. Because the implications are, if you're right, and I think like you, I'm going to lose my whole world. And so this whole thing degenerates into this emotional thing. And I think we have to be a little bit more sensitive about what you're dealing with people. It's really strong in the church world. I mean, the church world is as we've talked about many times, almost cultic, right? In their loyalties and their worldviews. And it's and I mean, if you look back historically, there's probably more humans that have died in the name of God and defending a theology or a worldview than probably most world wars. I mean, it's unbelievable how far people will go, right, to defend the religious system. So when you're going down a road here that has huge implications, right? Because what's at stake is a lot for most people. You know, there's a book out there. This is just, again, a sidebar. If you guys want to check it out, there's a book out there called Born to Rebel. And the whole theory is basically birth order. And what he talks about, he goes all through history, and there's always in every family the black sheep, right? It's that one rebellious sibling or child. It usually doesn't happen unless you have three or more kids. Well, history has been changed by the black sheeps. It's the rebellious ones who have ended up being the innovators. And so the system mitigates and does everything it can to cause you to conform, but it's weakness, right? It perpetuates all the flaw, everything, right? So it takes somebody that's a bit obstinate and rebellious, right? So this is one of the paradoxes I found in Christianity, right? Because we're all taught that we need to submit and obey. Good people obey. History, though, is driven by those that rebel.
Well, I knew you would have an opinion. I wanted to talk to you.
I have a perspective.
You have a perspective. We both have perspective. Interestingly, yeah. They both seem to match, which is unusual.
Well, it is fascinating because you and I, like I said, we start from very different places, but we tend to end up always in the same place.
Yeah, we do. We're like the family circus where Billy's going all kinds of different directions and he finally ends there.
But. Well, hopefully people will find it helpful because I think, you know, based on reading some of the comments, you know, I think a lot of people identify with our journeys and like, yeah, I see that too. You know, that's been my journey. Painful, but, you know, I'm grateful for what I understand now.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for doing this.
All righty, buddy.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR. And for more about Mike Bickle and IHOP KC, you can read Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, The Kansas City Prophets, and The International House of Prayer.